spin a half, charge one, carry number one, make a number zero. And this is, again, thought to be a U-D combination. The neutron would be similar. This is a U-D-D bound state. Yeah, so it's at 940, I guess, MeV. Half, one. And the anti-particles would have the opposite charge, you know, they'd be minus one, minus one.
Oh, what happened? The charge of the neutron be zero?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Right, the nine. You guys are fighting for the nine.
Did I get that?
No, yeah, no. Where is that? So, the short version of all these bound states is that there's really a bunch of quarks here, right? So the elementary part of this story would have been that there's an up quark, which has a mass of about 5 MeV.
So what does the baryon number stand for? Because you have one for the proton, but you have three quarks in it.
Yeah, so each quark will have a third.
Okay.
It's just, historically, it was people, you know, protons never, if you kind of think quantum mechanics more or less says that anything that's not forbidden is compulsory. So if you're allowed to decay into something, you should. And the more energy you can liberate, the more phase space you'll have, so the higher the rate will be. And so you could ask, well, if you have protons, and if there was no baryon number conserved, then protons should be decaying all the time into plenty of ions or electrons. And they don't. So that the understanding of why that was true was the, in the 60s, that was the hypothesis of the baryon number. There's a conserved thing called baryon number for which the proton was the lightest thing. And so it couldn't decay because there was nothing it could decay into which had the baryon number. And so one of the things, the standard up model will not have as its one of its inputs baryon number conservation. But one of the beautiful things is that baryon number conservation as a good approximation emerges as a consequence of the standard model. So that's a pretty picture. So it's going to have. The charge of the up quark is was it minus a third?
Two thirds.
We should go figure it out here, right? Yeah. So two thirds, minus a third. Two-thirds. Yeah, two thirds, right. Two-thirds. Baryon number will be that third. No electron number. The down quark, which we've already hit, has got a mass of about 10 MeV. So have minus one third, carry number third, zero, 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 zero. Anybody who has a charge has to be different from their antiparticle, because the antiparticle has to have the opposite charge. Kaon was a strange quark. It had a mass of, depends on how you measure it, but it's in the ballpark of, let's say, 150 MeV. It's going to have, it's like the down quark, so it's minus third charge, third baryon number, and no electron number. I did do this. Now there are other quarks that we know about. There's the charm quark, which is like the F quark. Its mass is in the GeV range. This is where I should have brought the data from. It's something like 1 GeV. Spin a half, charge 2/3, carry number a third, alpha number. There's a bottom quark, which is like the strange quark. Its mass is about, I want to say 5 GeV. I think these are the role of, you know, and I'm pulling this with the memory, my memory's really bad, so. That's what the particle data book is for. It's, these are the things you look up. Third. And then there's the top quark. Its mass is about 180 GeV. Then there's also the tau lepton, which I should have got to before the dot quark probably, because its mass is again, like 1 GeV. And the anti-tau would be, you know, plus one, minus one, minus one. There's the W boson, the W minus, plus minus, let's say. So W minus, I guess, well, minus plus. That's about 80 GeV. Spin one. Charge minus plus one. Baryon number zero. No lepton number. And this is then zero. About 90 GeV. And that's it up here, like I said. Okay, three neutrinos, three charged leptons, six quarks, three electroweak bosons, and the photon. Oh, and the gluon. So there's a. So these bound states are not bound by electromagnetic forces. They're not bound by the weak interactions, which are going to be what these things are involved in. So they're. There's believed to be, and it's not just at the level of that. Like, there's evidence, if you count up the spins they carry by the proton in a collision for all the quarks, it adds up to about half of what is in the quark, in the proton. And the rest of it is being carried by other constituents, which are to do with the mediating the force that's holding the proton together. And these are the gluons. So there's eight of these things.
And is there no kinetic energy that kind of adds to the? Like, I mean, if they have like suppose they're bound, but they have like total or dual momentum.
Yeah.
That would add kinetic energy, and that would add to the mass.
Right. That's why, for instance, these things are massless, and these quarks are 5 and 10, but the mass of the proton was more than that. It was something more like 1,000, and so the difference was what you said, the electromagnetic energy.
And the binding.
Yeah, they're all kind of in the same ballpark. Because if these things are consistent with their size is something like a Fermi, and so if you think of the momentum associated with confining something, and the certain principle says is moment, you know, the so if you have something confined to a region, which is like a Fermi, that's like 10 to the minus 15 meters or something, right? So h bar over a. I guess C is something like 100 MeV. So that's the kind of momentum that you've got. C, I guess. And so the energy associated, you know, would have been the square root of P squared plus M squared. But this is a lot bigger than the mass of that for these quarks. So that's a good approximation. It's just the momentum. So the energy associated with this, just confining in that small region, is going to be in the ballpark of hundreds of MeV. And then there's also going to be interaction energy. And so the reason why there's a lot of stuff happening around the GeV is to do with the fact that there are forces in town that are confining things at a scale which is not so far from GeV.
So how do we know, what do you mean by the size is about one from, what does that mean for energy?
It's hard to say that without getting into the details of how they think. So more or less what's happening is, depends on how you ask the question, but one way you could ask that would be to take a low energy collision of a proton with other things, and then you sort of take a photon or something. And then if you do that at low energies, the proton behaves, the photon is kind of interacting with the whole proton. So really, this proton is a bag of things, right? There's three charges inside. The gluons are neutral, but the quarks are inside. If the wavelength of your photon is long compared to that, then it's going to scatter off the whole proton. And it doesn't do that in a way which is behaving like a proton is point-like. If you compare the cross-section that you see as a function of angles with the cross-section that you would have expected if the proton was a point, like with the Rutherford cross-section, you see differences. And those differences allow you to infer things like the charge radius, and there's a more precise definition of what you mean by the size of the proton, but it depends on exactly what it is you balance out the proton from what you get. So if you did it with a neutrino, you'll get a slightly different radius, but they're all kind of in this ballpark. But if you do this at very, very high energies where the momentum transfer is extremely high, then what happens is the photon just scatters, it'll scatter with it one quark, and it'll not get out, and the rest of the proton won't have time to react. And so if you do the very high energies, and it won't really just make sense to ask this question, because you're going to be seeing the dynamics of a free quark rather than a you know, bound proton. And that's very much like what would have happened in a, you know, in an act. If you bounce atoms solely off things and the whole atom scatters, if you really hit with something hard, then it should be fine.
I have a basic question. In a nuclei, or in a proton or something, do the gluons pick up mass? Do they?
No. That's hard to know. That was one of the, you know, people were thinking along those lines. That's Weinberg's story, right? Is that the theory, he said, first guy to get the theory of W is right? Okay. And he was originally trying to do that for gluons. And it wasn't working. So that's the point he came, you know, the eureka moment was when he figured out that he was actually getting the quantum track. So these are massless, as far as you know, because there's no Higgs mechanism going on. Okay, spin one. No electric charge, no conductivity. So this is worrisome naively, because you would have said, well, if they're massless, then the difference between these things and atoms is not so much that they're bound and that you can knock them apart. The thing is, for atoms, you frequently see free electrons and free nuclei. And it doesn't bother you. They bind in atoms at low energies, but they separate at high energies. You might have thought that if these protons and neutrons and other things are bound states of quarks and gluons, you should see the bound states, but you should also see the quarks and gluons if you think at higher energies. And it's true that you can interpret scattering in terms of the constituents, but you never see free protons, free quarks, and free gluons as final states in a reaction. They always come out as one of these bound states. So there has to be a story here. In particular, you don't see masses. You would have thought masses things would be easy to see. You never see very, very long wavelength gluons that you can, you know, radiate with an antenna like you can for protons. And so there has to be a story here as to why that's true. And that's a long song and dance. But,
okay. Supposing you did have them, how would you even detect them? Because they, like, with these characteristics, they won't interact with anything else.
Oh, but they interact like gangbusters with the quarks and the gluons. That's why they bind. So they're the strongest interacting in the whole bank. So they'll be easy to see. If the quarks and gluons were there, you'd know it, because you'd see fractionally charged. And the quarks you can see for sure, because they've got fractional charges, so those are really easy to see.
So for the W's and the Z's, does their mass then depend on the element that they're in?
So. Yeah, it could do. In fact, that's also true for other things. I mean, photons, the mass which depends on the environment it's in, right? If you put a photon in a plasma, then there's a plasma mass, which is to do with charges like the screen, the electric fields. It depends on how you measure mass.
Yeah.
But there's lots of them. Meissner effect, you know, if you're a superconductor, the fields fall off exponentially.
Yeah.
And there's a real gap there. You can't produce in a superconductor photon with arbitrarily small energy like you can vacuum. So all these things will have a mass which depends on the environment there. And that's to do with the story that I told you last class, that, you know, we have this Hamiltonian, which is the free part and the interacting part. And when we say that we're looking at particles like this in a reaction, typically what you're thinking is that in the reaction you're looking at, for most of the time, the free part is the whole story and the interaction part is the small perturbation of that. And you're doing that normally because they're physically separated, and they can come together when the interactions turn on, and they separate again. But that split of free and interacting is also meant that if you calculated the mass was not literally the parameter in the free part of the Lagrangian; it was that plus corrections coming in due to the interactions. And so, if you're in that will know about what state was that you prepared the system in, and so that's how the environment comes in. That if you really calculate the physical mass, you'd have to tell me what state the system was prepared in, and then you'd calculate the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, say, and it would have a contribution coming from the free mass, but it would also have a contribution coming from the interactions, and the relative size depends on the details of where you're doing it.
So what's the mass of the graviton?
Mass of the graviton?
the mass of the particle that produces gravitational fields. Is it that mass? The mass is in the Hamiltonian, or is it?
It's the same thing as the inertial mass. And that's true for the bound states true as well. So if you take the, it's not, at the top of my head, I can't remember what the experimental limit is now, but I think it's true that the bounds actually, if you ask for all the evidence, is that the gravitational mass is really seeing the total energy in the system, including the binding energy. And that includes all these interaction effects. And so if you ask for, it's hard to ask for the quarks, because if you're not getting a free quark, it's difficult to know what you meant by the inertial mass. But if you, or the gravitational mass, but for something like an electron, where you actually can separate it by itself, and then you can, do an inertia experiment, then the mass we measure its resistance to forces is the same mass as appearing in the gravitational, when it acts as a source of the gravitational force. And for the bound states, the same thing's true, that if you take the total energy, including the binding energy, and look at the rest mass for that, then if you ask for the inertia you get, it's the same as the gravitational.
Doesn't that just follow from Einstein equations?
Do you believe that the coupling of gravity? And the reason it's relevant is that there's no chemical composition dependence to these entities, this gravitational mass, and there's a really good constraint on it. I think it's at the level of 10 to the minus 10 of the gravitational force or something like that. If the range of the force is between here and the moon and the sun. That tells you that the binding energy is really gravitating too. And so the whole story of the cosmological constant is to do with the vacuum as energy, which is quantum mechanical, and it appears not to be gravitating. And part of what makes it a puzzle, so many people will say, so quantum effects don't gravitate. But there's really evidence that quantum effects do gravitate, because binding energies include quantum effects, like the Lamb shift, and that's all gravitating in bound states, as far as you know. So it's really an important constraint experimentally that binding energies gravitate. Yeah?
So if we're saying that gravitation is mediated by the graviton, and that binding energies also gravitate, are there gravitons just kind of being produced by the binding energy there?
It'll be more clear what it means to have these continuing forces in a second. But in the same sense that you can think of charged particles are exciting photons, and so the photons are around us, the same thing would be true for gravitons. And it's kind of a little bit of a swindle saying it that way. But there were gravitational fields around us, and one way to think of those is that they're like states that have been set up. You'd have a more complicated state around you than the no particle state, because you've got no energy cost to producing these things, and they're bosons, so you have as many as you like, and it loves it. So,
how do you measure the gravitational effect of an electron?
Well, one way to do it is to take a whole bunch of them, in the Earth.
and then you're not measuring them independently, you're measuring them with the repulsive forces and the energy from that.
Yeah, so for individual particles, I don't know what the best bound is. People have trapped, I can't remember if it's electrons or atoms, probably atoms, individual atoms, and you can do a phase, so you can let them fall in a gravitational potential, and you can look at them, let them interfere with one another, because you keep them coherent. And so then you're very sensitive to energy changes, and that does see that there's a binding energy like you would have thought from gravity. But I think that was actually done for atoms, not for individual electrons. So at the top of my head, I don't know what the best bound is on the individual electrons gravitating. But there's lots and lots of indirect evidence from things that they're made of gravitating. And if you do it at incredibly high accuracy, gravitating exactly the way it should do. The thing with electrons is that most of the mass of an atom is in the nucleus, so that you're really mostly seeing the nucleus and how it couples. But at 10 to the 10 level, there's got to be a constraint in there somewhere, and what it is, I'm not sure how to know. All right, so there is the particle, so now what we need to do is abstract from that what the symmetries are and what the transformation rules under the symmetries of the particles. And so I just don't give you the list as to what, so, and it's a long historical story, kind of figuring out why these charge assignments were made, but what we're going to do is just take all the elementary ones, so that except for that, we're going to keep the quarks, the Higgs bosons, and leptons. The leptons, I should say this now, I guess, that things that can that participate in the strong interactions, that tends to be the gluons and the quarks, are called hadrons because they're a big part strongly interacting is what those things are. And the leptons are the ones that don't. So that's the, and typically, the historically, I think that probably included things that were not just charged fermions and neutrinos, but it's become really leptons means the charged fermions and neutrinos. So the photon, for instance, doesn't make very strong interactions, but it's not what I call a lepton. And mesons, I guess, is another thing that was the distinction between baryons, the proton, and neutron, and the other things involving three quarks from the things involving a quark and antiquark. So that's you can measure that with the baryon number. So the mesons are the ones that were have no baryon number, but are now it's kind of meson is a I think it was probably used in the past in a way which was a little bit ambiguous at some point, because when the muon and the pion were first found, they were all mesons, and then mesons came to mean, I think, the one built by quarks as opposed to the muon isn't called the new meson so often anymore. So there's a lot of verbiage that is really more historically interesting than anything else. But I'll use it so that, so baryons will be the things with three quarks. Mesons I won't use so much without qualifying it. Leptons will mean the charged electron, muon, the tau, and the neutrinos. And hadrons will be the anything built with quarks and muons. So we need so for the whole gauge story, we need to know what the group is that we're going to ask for the transformation rules of, and that's we'll know how many generators of the group there will be by counting how many spin one particles we've got. And so so the spin one particles. So we have the photon. W, Z, and the 8 gluons. And we also know who couples to whom, right? So these guys couple to each other, because this carries electric charge, and electric charge is the thing that photons couple to. We know that none of these guys take part in the strong interactions, so there's no coupling between these two guys. There is coupling between the Z and the photon, but it's not anywhere near as strong as coupling between the photon and the W, because it has no charge. And so whatever we're thinking of has to have that kind of a hierarchy. Now, you may not remember this, but if you looked at how the spin one particles couple to things in the way I was telling you in the previous classes, things do not couple to one another if the corresponding generators of the group commute with one another. So this is kind of telling us that whatever's going on in the strong interactions is commuting with whatever's going on in the other two. So the summary which captures what's going on experimentally, as far as we know, is that the group that we're looking for is SU3, which I put a subscript C for color. That's because there's another SU3 running around that is not color.
So how do we know it's Q?
It's going to be, I'll have to build up the experimental evidence as, right now I'm just telling you that this is the thing that turns out to work. But then there's going to be down the road various tests as to how do you know the vague gluons. If as a mathematics question, you're looking for something in rank 8, so that you can kind of go through the list of whether all the rank 8 groups are. And there's more than one, so that it could be other things that digest the 3. And the part of the story will be that the fermions have to come in triplet representation. And there's a whole song and dance that will come out as I kind of go through the constants of the model. So ask it again at the end of the term. So I'm just telling you what's going to turn out to be this is the model. So there's an NSC2 cross U1. So this is the stuff that's supposed to describe the photon W's and the Z's. And this is the blue ones. Now C here is for color. So the charge associated with this SE3 is called color. And the subscript here, L is for left, because it's going to turn out that only the left-handed particles transform under this group. And the Y here is that this is called is for hypercharge. And that's to distinguish it from the U1 that which I'll call U1 maybe EM for electromagnetism. So this is not the U1 electromagnetism. This is the U1 electromagnetism is a linear combination of this thing and one of the SE2 generators. It's going to turn out. I'm not sure to what extent you're all, you know, up to speed on what SU is for these groups. I mean, so the notation UN means n by n unitary matrices, and S means it's a determinant of one unitary matrices, so it's special unitary. We did ON with an N by N orthogonal matrices and so on. So what you're thinking you should be seeing is I should be giving you three component column vectors which will be multiplied by a 3x3 unitary matrix of determinant 1, and that'll be a symmetry problem. That's what you're thinking. I should be giving you things that are two component column vectors that will be acted on by a 2x2 unitary matrix at some point, and that'll be symmetry, and that's what this is going to be. And this is a phase, so you know, I get to multiply a complex thing by a phase. And the phase I multiply by is not weighted by the electric charge, is what I'm telling you here when I say that Y is different from, I might call this Q as well. So Q will be electric charge, and this will be some other charge, which I haven't talked about yet. So that's what the subscripts mean. So this is, let me just write that. So unitary N by N is the determinant one.
It's clear enough. Are they constrained to be that, or is it possible that it could be something else? Are they constrained experimentally that it has to be that? Or
it's very the particles we know about, it's really well constrained.
So supposing there's no other particles, does it have to be that one?
There's absolutely no other particles, including the Higgs, and
well, maybe including the Higgs.
It still doesn't get gravity though.
Right? Yeah, this is putting gravity aside. Yeah.
So if there's no gravity, if there's the Higgs, and there's no other particles, do they have to be that?
Yeah, there's really good, and so for the SE2 cross U1, the evidence is really, it's better than the percent evidence. That the couplings, all through the 70s, there were proposals as to other groups. Like, instead of SE2 cross U1, one that used, you know, it was an O3 example, where instead of having a W and a Z, before they discovered the Z, you could have weak interactions with W's and photons if you had O3. Rather than SE2 cross U1. And so lots and lots of proposals were made. And they make different, you'll see they make different predictions of exactly what the couplings are of the various charged particles to the spin 1 particles. But once people discovered the W and the Z and picked the Z, and then they started looking at it, you can measure its couplings really well because you can produce it on a resonance, and then you really see that you got a very, very clean, you have E plus E minus produces a Z with almost no uncertainty in the initial state, and then you can watch it decay, and they produce millions of them. So they, billions of them. And so you really know very accurately what the couplings are of Z, and it's exactly what the SE2 cross U1 theory says. So there's very little room for doubt that if these are the particles involved, the SE2 cross U1 is right. And the SE3, I think it's also true, although they're the, I think probably they're the, I'm less up on what the alternatives were to SE3, but it comes down to, there's a lot of, it's dirtier there because you're asking about the properties of bound states. It's true that you know, at high energies, it turns out that once you're at energies well above a few GeV, then the strong interactions become weaker and weaker and weaker. And so you can test them in the same way that you test the electroweak ones. And the tests are a little bit less precise because you're not sitting on a blue one rather than anything. But it's true that the things run the way SE3 tells you it's supposed to run. And so there's a good evidence that it's SE3, but I don't know if I can help play the precision of that evidence. Yeah.
are the cosmic constant of these kind of groups? Because different groups have different, produce different kind of cosmic constants, which could be seen in interaction or everything.
You mean Kelvin constants?
No, Casimir constants.
Casimir. Depends on what you mean. I mean, like, the Casimir energies are measured for typically only for very long range forces. Like, you mean like boundary dependence of energies? Is that what you mean by Casimir?
No, just for the group theory of
two bodies. Oh, you mean the Casimir invariance of the groups. Yeah, that's part of the assignment of charges. That's all to do with how you assign charges to these particles, which I haven't written down yet. But when I tell you the representation, then that's going to carry with it all the eigenvalues of the Casimir of the various groups. But that's kind of how you would extract. That's part of how you extract the predictions. But what I'm not completely sure of is the level of precision. I would say it's probably 1% as well. For the strong interaction, there's a lot of evidence as to what's going on for these, the gluons, and the, because there's lots of data on what strong interactions do.
I mean that the difference between SU2 or, for example, like O group.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be in Casimir invariance also, which should be seen in interactions also.
Well, it's easiest to think about, if you think of a specific other group, so they think of another rank 8 group. And then there's real evidence that there's only three colors of quarks, and that we'll get to the pi and decay rate depends on the number of quarks. So it's, so the rate for pi zero is decay to 2 photons in a rate, which is proportional to the number of colors, and so you really measure the number of colors there. So there has to be a group which has a three-dimensional representation of the quarks within them, and I don't know how many of them there are that have pi. Because you could say that you don't know that there's a gluon, because you know you count the quarks as a gluon. And so if you go through the list of groups that have three-dimensional representations, I don't know how big they are, but there's not that many of them, and I guess O3 you could have done, which is like SU2. But that would say there's only three gluons, and then the running of the coupling is different than it would have been. So if you kind of just say rather than, you know, what's the evidence this is right? What's the evidence that it's not this other alternative? Then it's easier to be much more precise with that. And it's and the evidence is very good. But exactly how to kind of tell you. But you'll see it kind of evolving as we go along that all the things we're going to be calculating are part of the evidence. So when you put them all together, you see the whole package. It's not that any one thing works, it's that the whole thing works. So there's a description of the bound states. There's a description of the dynamics of the bound states. There's a description of the decays of the constituents. There's a description that tells you when which of those descriptions is the right one to use. And it all works together. And so it's not so much that it's any one thing is decisive. It's that the whole thing all points in the same direction is what really makes it convincing. So the freedom we have in the group is not so much what the existing particles are doing. It's what other particles we haven't discovered yet are doing. And at some level, you have some freedom as to what the neutrinos are doing this. So the neutrinos, as you'll see, the left-handed ones, you have to, they're really tied down what they do, but the right-handed ones, there's a lot of freedom in what they do. And so that's where most of the freedom lies. Right. So let me now tell you the particles and their how they transform into that group, those groups. So let's start with the leptons. So what I need to do is I'm going to list. What I'm getting down is how so far that's all spin one particles, right? If we take the elementary guys in this list, so if I throw away the pions and the kaons and the protons, everybody else has a spin a half, because the gravitons and the leptons anymore. The neutrinos, the leptons, the quarks are all spin a half, so that they naturally divide into the spin a half and the spin one. Spin one is all to do with the gauge group. The gauge group was chosen that way. There's 8 generators of SU3 for the gluons. There's 4 for SU2 plus U1 for the 4 components of a charge W, a neutral Z, and a photon. And what's missing is how the fermions transform. So what I need to do, so the short way to tell you that, the shorthand is to say, I just tell you the dimensions of the representations that these things live in. And for SE3 and SE2, I just do that by telling you the dimensions. So it's either a doublet or a triplet or a, you know, a quadruplet or whatever. And for U1, I can kind of tell you the charge. So for electromagnetism, the rule was we took fields under electromagnetism, they rotated by some sort of a charge. And then I got to choose this number. So I chose it to be -1 for electron and so on. And so what I'm going to do is I'll tell you what that number is for all these various fermions. And so that means that whatever you choose to normalize omega, I'm telling you the relative size of all these phases given the first one. And I tell you the how do you think transform the number you want. So the way I'll write that is, I'll write out explicitly the transformation rules too, but I'm going to write up things that would be, I'll give you, R1, R2, actually I'll call it maybe R3, R2, Y. So I'll tell you the size, this will be the dimension of the SE3 representation, and this will be the dimension of the SE2 representation, and this will be the hypercharge. So this will be the thing that appears in the normalization of the phase. So let's start with the leptons. I start with the leptons because they don't feel a strong interaction, so that means they're going to be invariant under the SE3 group. So they're singlets under the SE3 group. So we've got electron, how many of them are there? First thing we have to decide is how many irreducible fermions we have to keep, and that means how many left-handed or how many Majorana fermions we have to keep. So we've got three neutrinos, and I'm going to suppose for now there's no other neutrinos besides those three. So that's three, and they could have been their own antiparticle, probably, because they don't carry electric charge. They don't carry baryon number. They carry electron number, muon number, tau number. But we don't know if that's something which is conserved, if those things are conserved separately. There's nothing wrong with those things being, you'll see, there's a story here that we're going to get to later on, but if they're massless, there's no issue at all. There's no inconsistency with there being just three neutrinos and there being them having carrying a lepton number. If they're massive, then there's more of a problem there because the mass that you would write down for three neutrinos tends to break that number. So there's an issue for neutrinos specifically, given that they now appear to have a mass. And the evidence for that is to do with this evidence that the electron number is a new number, a tau number, not conserved. There's an issue there as to whether the neutrinos are their own antiparticle. And I'm going to take the conservative point of view that they are their own antiparticle. And you'll see that the standard model predicts it to be massless. So there's going to be something. The one thing that we know is wrong with the standard model, the way I'm going to lay it out for you, is that the neutrinos are not doing what they should be doing. And so that's something I'll come back to once we go through it more. For the charged leptons, we get the electron, the muon, and the tau. And they're all electrically charged, so they can't be their own antiparticles because the antiparticles have the opposite electric charge. So that means that they're all represented by Dirac spinners because they have different particles and antiparticles. And each of those is two Majorana spinners. So we can think of the electron as being two states. Or another way of saying that is that the left-handed electron and left-handed positron are two states that are independent of one another. Under CPT, they turn into the right-handed electrons and the right-handed part of positron. Whereas the neutrinos, the left and right-handed parts could interchange under CPT. So I'm looking for three electrons, three neutrino states, and six charged lepton states, because the charged leptons are different from their antiparticles for sure, because electric charge makes them different. So So the fields would be, I'll say nu I, where I goes from 1 to 3. Then for the leptons, I have to have two types, which also have three copies. So we'll have, lepton I. And then what do I call the other one? Let me use E. I use D, and I think I use capital E. So the left-handed part of this will be the electron, the left-handed electron, the left-handed muon, and the left-handed tau. And the left-handed part of this field, actually, the way I'm going to do it, I think, is I'll make the right-handed part of this field, the electron right-handed, the muon right-handed, and the tau right-handed. And so the left-handed part of this field would be the left-handed positron, the left-handed mu plus, and the left-handed tau plus.
Does the antithesis here have anything to do with the quantum
fields? It's related to the there's two spin states, and so it's if they're massive, I can't quite use handedness because it's the subtlety here is that there's what I'm talking about here is chirality, and that's to do with the gamma fives that are going to be in the Lagrangian. Whereas for massless particles, you talk about helicity, which would be the component of momentum in the direction of the component of spin in the direction of momentum. And that's a Lorentz invariant thing because you could just run a speed of light, you can never boost past it, so you can make it go the other way. And so for massive things like these ones, helicity is not a good quantum number because you can go to the rest frame and they have two spin states. So what I mean here is the field. So you'll see what I mean when I write it down. It's the field which has involves the 1 plus gamma 5 and 1 minus gamma 5 of the negatively or charged state in the Lagrangian. So it's not really...
Think of it. Physically.
You can't think of this quantum number as being a physical charge that it's carrying, but what I'm really getting at here is the number of things you have. So the counting is the same as the physical. So the way you count it physically would be the electric charge and the spin state. In the rest frame, there's two spin states. It's really true, there's two spin states for the electron in the rest frame, and there's two spin, and so you can either think of this as being that you have a field for each of the two spin states for the electron, or, and the fields are labeled by left and right, and I have two labels, which correspond to the two spin states. Okay, so now I need to tell you how these things transform. And so let me erase this now because it's put it here. So, minus five. So how they transform in this notation is that they're singlets because they don't transform under SK3 at all. And in fact, I'm going to actually group these guys together into one. So let me do this guy first. So the right-handed electron does not take part in the strong interactions. It turns out that the weak interactions also involve, they're consistent with involving only the left-handed neutrinos so far. So the right-handed anything, except for, let me take it back, the right-handed anti-neutrinos do take part in the weak interactions. But the weak interactions are consistent with not involving the right-handed charged particles at all, right-handed electrons. It involves the right-handed positrons because that's the quantity of the electron. But these guys, they don't involve these guys at all. And they're hypercharged, so that says that they don't transform under the SE3 or the SE2. That's why I chose them first, it's simplest. But they do transform under the E1. That's why they take part in, they have to take part in electromagnetism. So at some point you have to know about the photon, and so somebody has to couple with them. And that's going to show up as being, we're going to give these guys hypercharge. Plus one. And you'll see how to relate this electric charge in a second. I have to first identify where the photon is before I can claim it. The rule, I'll actually tell you now. I'll tell you in a second. I'll tell you. Well, let me tell you. I have to tell you this first. So these guys do not transform under SA3, which is to say they do not take part in the strong interactions. They do transform under the SA2. And they are the two components of a two-component column vector on which this SE2 symmetry will act. So this is a two-component representation. And then they have a hypercharge. And the hypercharge is going to be minus half, I guess. I got that right.
So what is that two-component?
So I'm going to write it explicitly in a second. So explicitly what this means is that if I take the Meyer on a thinner, which I'm always free to do, EI. I here is not the spinner index. I is the one that goes from 1, 2, and 3, meaning electron, muon, and tau. So that's the family index. So I'm not writing the spinner index, but each of these things are the four component, you know, Meyer on the spinner. So under these symmetries, the transformation rule is delta B. In general, what I would have had is delta psi. And I write the left-handed part, by which I mean 1 half 1 plus gamma pi times delta psi. That's the definition of what I mean by that. And that would be, so that's what this is what I meant by gamma left. Gamma left times I omega alpha by some generator T alpha acting on psi. For SU3. So this is the SU3 parameter. And so alpha here will run from 1 to 8. And then there'll be an SU2 transformation here, which will be I omega 2A, if you like. TA acting on psi. So here A is runs over 1, 2, and 3 for SU2. And then there'll be a hypercharge, so there'll be omega 1. Now the generator here is just a number, so I'll call it y. So this is u1y. That's the general transformation rule that I was writing before. And so I have to tell you, if this is a matrix, I'll have to write out. What I'm going to do is I'm going to group the quarks. Will have a label color, which will be a 3x3 thing. So maybe I should write the indices in here. I'd rather not because it's going to start making this in the mess. But think of this as being a. If something transforms under SU3, there will be more than one of these fields. And I'm thinking of this psi as being a column vector which has them all in them. And so, in fact, one of the best way to think of this is imagine taking all of these fermions, the electrons, the neutrinos, the quarks, and make a huge column vector of them all, the left handed part. And then these are matrices in that space, which has a lot of zeros in it. But what I'm doing now is just telling you where all the non-zero pieces are. I'm about to play with here. But this is the kind of format of the transformation in general. And so it's important to think that this thing is acting on a different part of the space than this thing is. Because, for instance, if in a way that we, when I write these things down, you'll see it more concretely. Before I do that, though, I want to say the reason I wrote the left-handed piece here is that remember, for Meyer on a spinner, the right-handed piece is the complex quantity of the left-handed piece. So saying this tells you how the right-handed piece transforms, and it transforms differently because of the complex conjugation starts to see all these eyes. So this implies that delta psi right, which is 1 half 1 minus gamma pi delta psi, is gamma right times. Minus I omega 3 alpha p alpha complex conjugate, not Hermitian conjugate. Minus I omega 2
alpha.
So where do these minus R? Oh, okay. Because if it's in Majorana, then this becomes, for Majorana spinner, psi right. Is a matrix times psi left complex conjugate. Because in spinner space, remember the left-handed piece and the right-handed piece, they transform as complex conjugates one another under Lorentz transformations. And so I had the freedom either to set these things to be zero, tell you what the left-handed guy does, or think of this as being Majorana, and I'm going to do that because that matches up to what I was doing for the general case of n fermions. And then this guy is always a complex conjugate of this guy. And so then if I write this transformation rule, I'm forced to write a complex conjugate here because that's the consistency with my Majorana condition requires. So I'm just laboring this because I'm going to always be telling you this, but you know for free what the right-hand piece is doing. And when you combine them, because of these minus signs, you're going to have gamma fives in the transformation rule, which you might not have expected to find. So I just want to make that clear up front. So let me just finish off with the statement.
Did you get that extra minus sign from that epsilon matrix?
That's buried in the M. But what I would do is I complex conjugate and multiply the whole thing through by M, and that's what converts, and then I'll have M psi left star all the time, and that's what I'm writing in psi right. So over there here I've got a psi right. And so that's epsilon is hidden in the psi right. So let me write this in that form now. So what this means is delta nu, so gamma left delta nu I is, there's no SC3 transformation, so the first thing is zero. Zero, so I don't have to write that term with omega 3. It does depend on, or sorry, the, oh shit, let me do this one first, that's the easiest one. EI. It also, so this is the omega 3 piece, this is the omega 2 piece, but it was a singlet, so it doesn't transform. Now I have to tell you the hypercharge, and the hypercharge is going to be I times omega 1 times y, and that's what this number is. So 1 times yeah. So every family, doesn't matter what family it is, they all transform the same way. And when I told you this number, all I'm doing is I'm telling you the number that goes in here for y. Now for this guy, I need to have something which is a two-dimensional thing that the SU2 matrices can act on. And so so what I'll do, and the two guys are the neutrinos and the charged leptons. So what I'll do is I'll call Li, I'll call it nu I and Di. Let me group these two fields into a two-component thing. So this is not spin space, this is two-component SU2 space. It's not family space because I've got one for every family index.
So you know, is there a reason why it's like you do it that way and why you choose two instead of
it's
two?
Because this will be clearer when I've read the interactions of it, but if you remember looking at the interactions when you had a spin one particle and two spin half particles, the matrix which goes with the spin one particle is telling you what transitions occur when you make the spin one particle. And so you'll see that the W particle will go with the matrix 0, 1, 1, 0. So it's the W particles will be emitted when you make a transition between electrons and neutrinos. And that's seen to happen. So for this one, gamma left delta L I is gamma left. There's again no SC3 piece, so I don't write this because it was a singlet. But now I've got an SU2, and the SU2 is going to act in this 2x2 space here. So I'll have I and omega 2a times, now let me write this as being it's a Pauli matrix, tau a over 2 times Li. And it also has a hypercharge, which is minus a half. So I omega 1 times minus a half Li. That minus bothers me, I think that's right. So here, I've written that TA is 1 half times tau A, and these are the Pauli matrices. So you know those are, you know, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. I've written those Pauli matrices before. And that's because there's a normalization dimension that I'm using for these. So that's explicitly what it means to be a doublet, and what it means to be a hypercharge minus a half. Now let me tell you the rule for the hypercharge, so you can check that this minus a half is right. The rule is, remember that the third Pauli matrix is diagonal. So T3 is 1 half tau 3. That's 1 half times the matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So I can talk about each of these fields having an eigenvalue of T3, whereas I can't under T1 and T2 because those are off diagonal. And so the bottom line is that the electric charge is related to T3, the eigenvalue of T3 and the hypercharge in this way. If I add them up, I get the electric charge. So we can check that now. So in the case of the right-handed field, this thing did not transform at all under SU2, so it has eigenvalue 0 for T3. And so the hypercharge should be equal to the electric charge, and it is. And you might say, well, it's not because I gave you plus one here, and the electric charge of the electron is minus one. But the rule here is this is for, since this is a minor ionic field, I have to tell you if it's the left-handed part or the right-handed part that I'm talking about. And I've given you this rule here for the left-handed part. For the particle destroyed by the left-handed part of the field. So this field, the right-handed piece of it destroys the right-handed electron, so the left-handed piece destroys the left-handed positron because of the complex conjugate. And so for the left-handed piece, the electric charge is plus one for this field, and that's why the hybrid charge is plus one. So now we can check for this guy. For the neutrino has eigenvalue plus a half for T3, and it's supposed to be neutral. So I have, for the neutrino, I have plus a half plus minus a half, and the hypercharge gives me zero, and that's the right hypercharge for the neutrino. So that works. And for the electron, it's the bottom component of the doublet, so it has eigenvalue minus a half. So I'd have minus a half plus minus a half would be minus one, and that's also a right charge for the electron. So I guess that is right, even though it looks like it. So that's a good place to break. And between now and the afternoon, you should work out what the corresponding choices are for the quarks. Because it's just applying this rule. So you, for the hypercharge, forget the color for now, but just for purposes of SU2 and U1, if you imagine that U and D and charge and strange and top and bottom come together in doublets the same way as the neutrino and electron do. You can, from that, since you know the charges, the electric charge of these guys, you can figure out what the hypercharges have to be for these fields to work. Any questions? The quarks are going to transform under SU2. The left-handed quarks are transform under SU2, and the right-handed quarks won't. No, so I'm just asking you this, and I'll tell you what the answer is in the afternoon. But it's a useful exercise to think it through before.